Looks really shimpish. Shimping. Doing nothing of any importance. No, I got no plans for Saturday night. I'm just shimping. Shimp alert. Sighting a shimp. Or being shimpish. The dog days. The month of January began to take on a Lord of the Flies feel. We were now a full month over schedule. Gone were the days of zany antics. We had entered the darkest, oddest days of the shoot. To kick things off, a fogger fire nearly burned our entire woods down. These handheld portable fog machines ran off electricity and relied on a volatile oil-based substance to create the clinging mist you see in horror films. The effect was great, but foggers tended to spit flames every so often. Tall, dry grasses surrounded the cabin and created a recipe for disaster. Next thing we knew, a fire appeared out of nowhere, and only a mad stomping session put out the conflagration. When you get tired, you become careless and lose the ability to sense danger. Late one night, after securing a light, Josh jumped down from the rafters and impaled his foot on a sharp, upturned spike. He yanked his foot off the nail, dragged himself over to a couch, and curled up into a ball. For the next several days, we'd peek into his room before shooting and see how he was doing. Josh, are you coming to the set today? No. Okay. Josh's diary, kept faithfully, chronicled the collapse of our youthful enthusiasm. Sunday, November 11th, 1979. It's a real strange grouping together of people. I'll wait to see how everyone functions as a team. Nevertheless, we're all here. All the equipment is here, so I guess we're making movies. Sunday, November 18th. This is only a week later, by the way. 5 more weeks. Lord God, this is going to be trying. Now about a month later, Monday, December 17th, 1979. Soon we'll be leaving for location again, and once again I'm dreading it. Last night was unquestionably the coldest yet, possibly zero, and just absurd weather to be doing extensive exteriors in. Aside from the fact that it's awful to be out personally, both lights and cameras resent it too. The Aeroflex BL freezes up regularly now and has to be thawed by the fire. Wednesday, January 16th, 1980. Today's shoot was just plain stupid. In about 10 hours, we got 2 shots. One took 1 hour, the other took 9. 2 more weeks of this will ruin me. Wednesday, January 23rd, scribbled on the back of a continuity log. I'm going insane. Nothing makes any sense. I can't keep my mind focused on a single thought. My mental processes have no continuity at all. I just want to have one uninterrupted day of thought, but Book of the Dead, the original title, will not end. The cabin was so rural that we never thought anything of leaving the equipment in place and going 4 miles, quote, home to eat lunch or dinner. The driveway had become so inaccessible that only a damn fool would try and steal anything. Or so we thought. Returning from a late-night lunch, we discovered that our power tools were missing. The loss? A skill saw, saber saw, drill, and chainsaw. The ironic thing about the whole incident was that a $20,000 Aeroflex camera sitting out in the open wasn't touched. Value is a subjective thing, particularly in rural Tennessee. This incident led us to post a watchman at the cabin after wrapping each night. That lucky person got to shiver on a hard floor next to the dying fire until someone relieved them the next afternoon. Just when our defenses reached an all-time low, we came face-to-face with an indescribable substance known as Goody's Chili. We returned to the house for lunch at 2 a.m., only to find Goody sound asleep in a Lazy Boy chair in front of a TV test pattern, surrounded by Snickers bar wrappers. When we asked him where lunch was, he groggily pointed to the stovetop. Dave.
Yeah, you guys have been working really hard for 6 or 7 nights, so I said, just come home and I'll make you guys a meal. I made this chili, a really intensive meat experience, 3 or 4 pounds of beef. I threw in some lamb and beans and a lot of jalapenos and Tabasco sauce and a lot of seasoning. Everybody comes home and they eat, and I got bread and cheese and sour cream, and it's like a real meal, and everybody's hungry, and they start eating like animals.
Bruce. Yeah, that's when the trouble began.
Dave.
Yeah, I went to bed, and then I came up the next morning and I saw Sam. He was asleep with his head on the table. You were underneath.
Yeah, I was underneath the table.
Yeah, you were snoring, and Rob was passed out in his chair.
Bruce.
No one was able to move after that meal.
Dave. Yeah, I woke everybody up, and Sam turned to me, and he goes, "You drugged me and violated me, didn't you?"
As if that wasn't bad enough,
There was so much leftover that we had the same meal the next night, and the same thing happened. 2 nights of work down the crapper because of Goodman's chili. See, with Goodman, you never really knew what kind of sustenance you were going to get from day to day. Another night, he confused baking powder with baking soda, and the crew was treated to pizza cake. Most of us threw our portions in the fire, Dave. As the weather became more volatile, so did Goody. After a while, he simply refused to bring the food down to the cabin.
No, the road's too slippery.
Yeah, no shit, Dave.
I'm going to leave it at the top of the driveway. Fuck it. I don't care. You're not paying me enough to bring it all the way down.
Yeah, sure, Dave. Whatever's convenient for you. We wouldn't want you to miss the soaps. Life at the house became surreal. Tom Sullivan slept in the laundry room. Apparently, he was fine with the idea of nesting among weeks of unwashed crew clothing. Eventually, a horrid stench began to emanate from the room. We secretly discussed Tom's hygiene, but someone had seen him take a shower a few weeks before, so it couldn't be him. Could it? After Tom returned home to Michigan, we discovered the source of the smell, rotting chicken bones that he had used for several ghoulish props. About 3 a.m. one night, Sam awoke to an eerie wind whispering through his bedroom window. Like the dedicated filmmaker that he was, he immediately rousted sound man John Mason. Sam, I woke John up and I asked him to record it because I thought it was so scary and so unique.
Bruce, and so you got a couple minutes of that or whatever?
Sam, yeah, and we wound up using it in the finished film a lot, actually. I couldn't believe it was natural. It sounded so fake.
Reality Bites. Our backroom telephone had been knocked off its perch so many times during the course of the shoot that to make or receive a call, you had to hold a delicate lever in place to keep from hanging up. One frigid night while shooting a difficult sequence, I got a cryptic call.
Joe's Pool Hall, who in the hall do you want? I answered, assuming it was Goody, calling to complain about something.
Who is this? The irritated voice wanted to know.
Well, who wants to know? I shot back, not recognizing the caller.
Bruce, this is Dad. When are you coming back?
I rubbed my eyes and tried to make a joke. Aw, never. You know, we're having way too much fun.
Quit screwing around. Have you heard from your mother? Dad asked, in an uncharacteristically stern tone.
No, why?
Because she's not here. I don't know where she went or when she's coming back.
What is that supposed to mean?
Just what I said. He sounded more sad than worried.
Well, God, I don't know, Dad. I mean, I'll be home in a couple weeks, I guess. I'm not sure.
Well, what's going on up there? Is everything all right?
I don't know. We'll talk about it when you get back.
Okay. Bye, Dad.
Dad?
It was too late. The phone had hung up on itself. On the home front, a problem that I didn't even know existed had reared its Hydra head. The whole thing was too hard to grasp, so I went back to the set and got a bucket of blood dumped on me.
That's a wrap. Sort of. Eventually, our house rental agreement expired, and we were forced to vacate. Apparently, there were big plans for this house. It was to be converted into a country brothel. Hauling out hastily gathered clothing and equipment, we passed the shiny brass beds of the new inhabitants. For shame, Bible Belt, for shame. The last few days of our shoot, the spent crew, all 5 of us, lived at the cabin. To stay warm, we burned any furniture that was no longer needed. There were still day shots and night shots to complete, so sleep wasn't really an option. But it didn't seem to matter. Getting the hell out of Tennessee was the only important thing. For sheer absurdity, nothing could top an incident with a man named Fats. This fellow who single-handedly perpetuated the redneck stereotype hailed from the bowels of Newport County. Now, this was an important distinction because it was one of the few wet counties in Tennessee, and Fats, a drinker's drinker, lived up to its reputation. He had visited the set with his girlfriend and small child many months before. His boy, all of 4, displayed a vocabulary that was about 70% expletives.
"Goddamn some bitch! Goddamn some bitch!" he would say repeatedly.
About 5 in the morning after our last night of filming, Fat's 1971 Plymouth Duster slid to a halt at the bottom of the driveway. You know, the one that had been long impassable? He was drunk and determined to get into the movie business.
"How my friends gonna know I knowed you if you don't put me in your picture?" he slurred.
We could only stare at each other in amazement.
Well, gee, Fats, we just wrapped for the night. Sorry," Sam explained as rationally as he could for a man who'd been up for almost 2 days straight.
"Wrapped? Hell, you put me in your picture."
We learned never to argue with a man who had a bullet hole in his car.
Sure, Fats, Sam shrugged. We'll put you in the movie. With that, we mocked up a few props and proceeded to act out a scene from Sam's student film, The Happy Valley Kid. Fats was given the role of college professor, and Josh was enlisted to portray the kid. Sam scribbled copious amounts of dialogue on the back of a script log and insisted that Fats adhere to every word. Come on, Fats, you want to be an actor, don't you? Well, let's shoot. Roll sound. Yeah, but I don't know my... Slate it, Sam bellowed. For some reason, I thought of Captain Ahab. Oh, shit, boy, I ain't ready for... Action, Fats. Action! His drunken bluster reached new heights as he vainly struggled with material way past his third-grade education, but by golly, Fats was a movie star. With that, on Wednesday, January 23rd, 1980, filming was declared kind of finished. Everything that didn't absolutely have to return to Michigan was placed on a stump and blasted to bits with the remaining ammunition. The scraps were then tossed on a giant heap behind the cabin and ceremoniously burned. To close out this life-altering experience, we gathered around the trap door, exchanged a few solemn words, and buried a primitive time capsule deep below the floor of the main room. This cigar box, filled with a spent shotgun shell, a sample of fake blood, and a handwritten visual code to the film, commemorated the culmination of 12 grueling weeks filming our first real movie. Chapter 19. Aftermath. Upon limping back to Michigan, my wrenched, poked ankle made this a literal thing for me, we found ourselves penniless and with an incomplete film. The cryptic phone call with Dad came to fruition as soon as I walked in the door of my house. My mother informed me that she was, in fact, leaving for good. After a borderline Vietnam experience, this was about the last thing I wanted to hear. It had been a long time since I cried, but tears flowed freely that day. Ironically, my oldest brother Mike was about to get married. The family picture at the wedding was a hoot. It was the classic Midwest, everything is all right on the outside portrait of a family in transition. The prospects for additional funding were equally as grim. But life goes on. We had come way too far to give up now. The nearby suburb of Ferndale, Michigan, provided cheap office space, and we settled into an old dentist's office. That seemed appropriate, since a good deal of our budget came from this profession, and raising money was a lot like pulling teeth. Ferndale was a quaint neighborhood. Tom, our building manager, lived with his Doberman Duke on the premises. I have no doubt that our 6 years there led to his early insanity. We attempted to adjust back to civilian life with uneven success. For some reason, I refused to shave until the film was done. This absurdity became self-evident once we did reshoots, and I had to shave. During this period, I slept on the floor of my room, insisting that it had been good enough for me during the shoot. We half-heartedly attempted to reestablish contact with some of the cast and crew. Our relationship with the actors was strained at best. Teresa, her real name, invited us to see her new routine at the local Comedy Castle, both with K's. I barely recognized her with all of her appendages. After the show, we exchanged sheepish hellos like two friends who had gotten drunk the night before and revealed some awfully personal things. Bruce, hey, Teresa, funny show, how's it going? Teresa, fine, now that I'm away from that hellhole in Tennessee. Bruce, yeah, it was a tough shoot, wasn't it? It was the worst experience of my life. Well, if it's any consolation, you don't know the half of it. Anatomy of a Lemon. Going into Evil Dead, I had what could be considered a reasonable car, a 1976 Opel Isuzu, the pseudo-foreign subclassic, according to Sam. The seeds of destruction were sown when Goodman, the belligerent cook, borrowed my Opel during the shoot. Yeah, Bruce, I gotta pick up some more film stock. Can I take your car to Atlanta? Yeah, sure, Dave, go for it. Upon returning, Goody wouldn't look me in the eyes. Good news is, I got the film stock, he said, avoiding my gaze. Yeah? What's the bad news? I ran over a cinder block. Nothing seemed specifically wrong with the car, but upon returning to Detroit, my Opel began to spew steam from the exhaust pipe. Now, I'm not a graduate of Mr. Goodwrench, but I knew that couldn't be a good thing. Sorry, bud. You got a cracked block, the mechanic said. That's, like, tragically bad, right? Nothing worse, but hey, what can you say? Goddamn foreign cars suck. He just had to slip that in. If I were a true Detroiter, he was intimating, I would have purchased an American car, and I wouldn't be having this problem, cinder block notwithstanding. The next day, I dropped off my Opel's title and loan termination papers to the neighborhood junkyard and walked away with a $50 scrap bonus. Typically, the month before, I had just paid off my car loan. It was time to bite the bullet and get a new set of wheels. Well, not a new set, any set. The Motor City wasn't big on mass transit. Buddy John Cameron worked as a bartender at the local bowling alley, the Strike and Spare, known affectionately as the Sit and Stare for its high-class clientele. A waitress there had a, quote, great car for sale for only $150. The odyssey began on a cold January day. I met Kathy outside her house to inspect her car, a 1973 Chevy Bel Air. It could have been a 1943 Nash for all I knew, because the car was covered by 2 feet of ice and snow. Between the two of us, it took so long to uncover the thing that the issue of whether it was a good car or a bad car became quite moot. Look, Kathy, tell you what, I'm sure the car is fine. Let me get the money together and I'll call you. Several weeks later, on another bone-numbing day, I returned with the cash. I just need to put a teeny bit of radiator fluid in it and should be ready to go, Kathy assured me, as she produced 2 jugs of generic antifreeze. Since my last visit, the snow had melted off somewhat, revealing a very black car. Upon closer inspection, I saw what appeared to be a paintbrush bristle stuck in the coarse layer of paint. Is that what I think it is? Kathy looked up from her refilling duties. Oh, yeah, the car was painted with house paint. With a brush? I added. Yeah, isn't that weird? She smiled, almost done. Walking around the car, I noticed a rotted, bashed-in rocker panel. Hey, how's the radio? Oh, I'm not much for the radio. I squinted at her. That was a very White House damage control kind of answer. Well, does the heater work? Kathy nodded vigorously, as if to make up for the last answer. Boy, does it! Yeah, that's what I thought. Does it? Eventually, the paperwork was exchanged, and I was out of there. The radio didn't work, and the heater was either off or on full blast. There was no in-between for this excellent American car. My first stop was the gas station. After filling up, I turned the ignition and nothing happened. No click, no whir, no moan, nothing. Since I was at a full-service gas station, I enlisted the help of an attendant. As he popped open the hood, a wave of heat engulfed him.
Whoa, she's pretty hot. Let me check the fluids.
Fluids, I just saw this lady add some, I mumbled to no one in particular. Using a rag to protect his hand from the glowing radiator, he peered inside.
Well, looks pretty empty to me. Let me dump some more in.
As he did this, a 3-foot stream of coral blue antifreeze shot back at him with a thump. The radiator was so hot it had rejected every drop of fluid. Apparently it was so riddled with holes that Kathy's antifreeze had passed right on through. As it coagulated in her driveway, I'm sure she knew exactly where that frozen blue puddle came from. A replacement, slightly used radiator would cost me $80. In retrospect, this was the point where any rational human would have paid for a tow truck, dumped the car on Kathy's lawn, and insisted on their money back. But I managed to convince myself that this was just a fluke. Aside from a little old radiator, what could possibly go wrong? This was a Saturday afternoon. By Saturday evening, the transmission was a thing of the past, another testament to the craftsmanship of mid-70s American cars. I remember thinking, how odd. Here I am pressing on the gas pedal more and more, and the car is moving less and less. I abandoned the piece of crap in a snowdrift on the side of the road. The next day, far too cold for any rational person to be rescuing cars, I let it sit. The following Monday morning, I forged out to retrieve it, but alas, there was no car to be found. It had been towed. $100 later, between the towing charge and the impound/storage fees, the car made its way to AMCO for inspection. There I had a lovely chat with the serviceman.
Well, I can fix her for $350.
Junk the car, I said, without a moment's hesitation.
What?
Yep, junk it. Do whatever you'd like. You don't really expect me to pay twice the amount of the car just to have it fixed, do you?
Well, now, wait a minute. That was for a full warranty, he backpedaled. I can do a limited warranty repair job for $250.
Junk the car, I repeated emotionlessly. I wasn't acting, mind you. I was dead serious.
Are you shitting me? Really?
Absolutely. It's not worth it to me. Come on. If I was made of money, do you think I'd be driving a car that was painted with house paint?
Okay, tell you what. I'll fix the car for $200, but there won't be any warranty or guarantee whatsoever.
It's a deal. Little did I know that this was just the beginning of an epic journey of repair. Here's just a sampling of journal entries over the remainder of that year. March 20th, muffler. March 28th, dripping transmission fluid. It died on April 8th. April 15th, attempted to retrieve dead car. Get bribe money, $30, paid bribe, found car at Kmart, had it towed back. May 5th, car died. May 11th, car troubles. May 28th, car died. Freon went crazy. June 16th, borrowed $100 from Don, my brother, again. Took to the car place, picked it up, it's working again. July 2nd, car troubles. July 6th, car died on I-75. Big traffic jam. Got towed 7 miles to a gas station. August 25th, gas station. Engine needs to be cleaned. August 29th, my car is sick. This is just like a broken record over and over again. This goes on eventually until January 21st of the next year of 1983. So in addition to the maladies listed above, I bought new tie rods and a drive shaft and endured a particularly wet year with a rear window that leaked like a sieve every time it rained. Other than that, it was a fine American car. There is somewhat of a silver lining to this tale of woe. Later in the year, when I could afford to buy a real car, I donated the beast to Will, a member of my church. A list of disclaimers preceded the transaction. Now, Will, you can have the car. Just take it. I don't want a penny, but I gotta warn you. This thing could fly off the freeway at any time or blow up or anything. I saw Will at a church function about a year later and avoided any contact with him. When he cornered me at the punch bowl, I knew I was going to get it. Bruce! Hey, Will, hey, long time, I said, not daring to ask about the car. Bruce, I got to tell you something. I know. Look, I warned you. How long did it last? A week? The car is great. Is great? Yeah, I still have it. It's in the parking lot. I haven't had a single problem with it, and I just wanted to thank you for such a trouble-free car. Chapter 20, The Quest for Moolah, Part 2. Having sold as much personal stake in the film as the three of us could justify, we proceeded to the next option, loans. This word soon became a permanent part of our vocabulary, and it manifested itself in every form. Personal loans, corporate loans, temporary loans, emergency loans, even bank loans. What resulted was a series of large, early 80s, point-and-a-half above prime rate loans from the National Bank of Detroit. At nearly 20% interest on over $100,000, it became clear to me why banks rule the world. The loans were secured by a double helping of personally owned blue-chip stocks, graciously put up by several long-suffering investors as a guarantee. Investors were also invited to loan us money directly and reap the same rate as the bank. Much to their ultimate pleasure, this became the highest source of profit for some of them. As the loans were deposited, some film gremlin kept sneaking into our checking account and throwing the money away with reckless abandon, or so it seemed. My day runner from that period told the whole story. Pick up a check from Mr. O'Connor. Take a check to the camera rental place. Sign the loan papers from Brian M. FedEx a check to the film lab. Pick up a quickie loan from Rob's folks. Pay off phone bill. When in doubt, keep shooting. The loans in all their forms allowed us to shoot the last third of our film in fits and starts. The first spring after our return, we filmed for 2 additional weeks in the Tappert Farmhouse in Marshall, Michigan. Here Sam Raimi began what would become a series of salutes between filmmakers. The Hills Have Eyes was a very effective independent horror flick, and we had great respect for Wes Craven's ability to capture raw terror on the screen. In one particularly grisly scene, played out in a ramshackle trailer home, a psycho bites the head off a small bird and drinks its blood. Behind him, Sam noticed a poster of Steven Spielberg's film Jaws torn in half, as if to say, as scary as Jaws was, what's happening in this film is much worse. Not to be outdone, Sam put a torn poster of The Hills Have Eyes on the wall of Rob's basement, as if to taunt Wes with, oh yeah, Hills Have Eyes is nothing. What's happening in Evil Dead is true horror. This set off a tip of the hat from Mr. Craven in his film A Nightmare on Elm Street. In it, a character is up late at night watching a film on television, none other than Evil Dead. When the sequel to Evil Dead rolled around 7 years later, Sam placed a torn poster of A Nightmare on Elm Street in a work shed. We'll see who ups the ante next. That summer, we shot for 4 more days to fill in a few gaps in the film and provide what Sam would call a little kick in the ass. These, quote, pickups ran the gamut from shots of blood spattering on a wall to an entire sequence where a character gets raped, literally, by vines. The end of the film required a climactic meltdown of the monsters when the character Ash finally defeats them. This required 3 months of animation shooting in the suburban basement of effects wizard Bart Pierce. Bart teamed up with Tom Sullivan, now speaking to us again, and their job was to give the end of the film a little oomph. Sometimes it was hard to tell what these eclectic animators were up to. Witness a typical wish list. Fake arm, saber saw, fake blood, wig, white eggs, necklace, dowel rod, heater. The heater was for them, since this sequence dragged on into the frigid months of a Michigan winter. My final shot as an actor in Evil Dead took place in that basement. Sam felt it was necessary to show my character interacting with this meltdown, and Alpo dog food proved to be the best substitute for monster guts. Somehow, being splattered in the face with an entire can, compliments of Sam, seemed a fitting end. A cutting we will go. We had a mountain of footage. Now the trick was to make sense of it all. In Detroit, film editors worked on 30-second car commercials. They didn't edit 90-minute gore flicks. However, several times a year, full-length industrial films are shot and, quote, feature editors are brought in to do the work. One such editor was Edna Paul. Through a series of referrals, she became our editor, but she was based in New York, so if we wanted her to cut the film, it had to be there. It was a lot closer than L.A., so that was good enough for us. Sam was the only one who absolutely had to be in New York, so Rob and I stayed behind while Sam, Edna, and her assistant, fledgling filmmaker Joel Cohen, pieced the film together. The editing process was fascinating. It was the first time that I realized how extensively you could manipulate film footage. Shots were often reversed, used out of order, or stolen from a different scene to make a sequence work. Bruce, so that's when you met Joel Cohen. Did you guys hit it off right away, or what? Sam. Yeah, he seemed like a nice, quiet guy. Some editors let their assistants cut a little bit, so he ended up editing the work shed scene, which he was really into because it was designed as a specific sequence. He made it better because he took 2 longer pieces and made them into 4 cuts, and it looked even better. The first assembly of Evil Dead came in at 117 minutes. This was quite an achievement, particularly since the screenplay was only 65 pages, some 30 pages shy of the industry standard. What impressed me most, however, was Sam's ability to slice his own material with steely-eyed brutality. I recall arguing with him about several large cuts he wanted to make. "Oh, but Sam, you can't cut that out," I reasoned. "It took a long time to shoot." "Let me cut it out for now, and next time we screen the film, tell me if you miss it." This was the right way to go. On several occasions, he'd refer to a given scene. "Hey, notice anything missing?" he'd ask. "No, I don't think so. The wood chopping scene is gone." Oh, yeah, sure, I knew that. This kind of perspective allowed Sam and his crew to whittle the film down to a lean 91 minutes. Blood? Simple. During the course of editing Evil Dead, Sam became good friends with Joel Cohen, the assistant editor, and his partner-slash-brother, Ethan. The Coens had concocted an idea for a thriller, but they too needed to raise money. The notion of filming some form of prototype appealed to them. But their twist was to do a coming attraction, like the film was already done. So, on a frigid February in rural New Jersey, Sam, Rob, and I pitched in to help. One scene called for a mortally wounded character to drag himself down a lonely road, refusing to die. That role, for reasons all too clear, was given to me. I was the current expert on blood and cold. The full-length film Blood Simple did pretty well for the Coens, and, well, you know the rest. Loud and clear. Eventually, the meltdown animation was completed and the film was cut together. Now we had to add sound. Lots of it. Horror flicks, while very visual, need just as much attention in the audio department. The concept of looping was relatively new to us. This is the process whereby actors replace poor or missing dialogue. In our case, there was plenty to replace. Looping to the uninitiated poses several challenges. One is synchronization. Actors have to match the exact cadence of their original reading. This is essentially a mechanical thing and can be mastered eventually. The other more intangible aspect of looping is recreating the urgency you felt in a windstorm, for example, or the emotion as a friend dies in your arms. In my case, first time out of the gate, I found out pretty quickly how fast a person's voice can blow. After years of this vocal torment, I now book my looping sessions in half-day increments and always carry homemade throat lube, a concoction of herbal tea, lemon, and honey. Pardon me while I sip. Ah, throat lube. Then there was that thing called Foley. Named after a sound pioneer, it is the non-vocal equivalent of looping, wherein organic sounds are added to enhance or fill in the on-screen activity. Evil Dead had its own unique sound requirements. Our characters stumbled through the woods, trampled across sticky floors, and chopped each other to bits. To record this, Sam and I dutifully followed the anal instructions of Joe Masefield, the supervising sound editor. Joe was an old-school New Yorker and lived on a diet of cornbread muffins.
Yeah, fellas, extra butter. Gotta have it.
And coffee. Joe had mapped out like an engineer where each sound would go, complete with a corresponding number, and a basic idea of how each sound could be made. Sam and I were the self-appointed Foley artists, so we brought in an arsenal of destruction, consisting of several uncooked chickens, a meat cleaver, a turkey baster, walnuts, a nutcracker, celery, and actual props from the film. Chickens substituted for any form of impaled, chopped, or pounded flesh. The turkey baster was wonderful for blood spurts and gurgling of any kind. Walnuts and celery became staples for breaking appendages. We also discovered that quarter-inch recording tape very handily simulated the sound of dead leaves, and an added bonus was that it never decomposed. Ask any of the old-timers at the Sound One Corporation in New York City, and they'll confirm that the stench of decomposing chicken flesh lingered for months in their studio. A trip to the library. Next on Joe's list were the, quote, hard effects, like train whistles, car honks, or bird chirps, items generally impossible to create by hand and usually found in a pre-recorded library. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that Sam and I snuck in a few recordings from our own library. Three Stooges sound effects recorded directly off the TV were cleaned up and proved particularly effective for eye gouges and body falls. Another item in great demand was the scare cord. This was any sharp, disturbing sound that could be used to jolt the audience when something sudden or scary happened on screen. These wound up being anything from gunshots to cymbal clashes. Sam, Rob, and I became possessed with enhancing the soundtrack. After a full day of mixing the recorded sounds together, a numbing process, we'd spend the better part of the night editing additional effects or dialogue on secret tracks. Joe Masefield had no specific designation for them, so they simply became known as X-tracks. To break up the grind, Sam and I would routinely sneak away at lunchtime to a video arcade called Fascination and dull our senses even more by playing rounds of Asteroids or Berserk. Sam, with his innate ability to blow the living crap out of anything and anyone, excelled at both. One day at the arcade, we were both surprised to see director Brian De Palma doing the same thing. Apparently, he had been at the same sound facility finishing up his film Blowout with John Travolta. Sam brazenly approached Mr. De Palma and half asked, half challenged him to a round of Berserk. De Palma, not exactly Mr. Amiable, agreed, and I'm pleased to say that Sam kicked his A-picture butt from one end of Broadway to the other. How low can you go? Pretty low. With a finished 16mm film, we could tour college campuses for years. We could screen our film on every aircraft carrier in the Pacific. But could we get it into theaters? No. To do this, we had to get the film enlarged or blown up to the industry standard of 35mm. Our investments were all sold off. National Bank of Detroit turned up its nose at the prospects of any more business, and every relative we knew had been tapped out. A phrase we began to hear a lot was, guys, no more means no more. Who could we swindle next? The answer was very close to home. I spotted my recently divorced dad whispering to himself in a lawn chair behind our house one summer evening. Mentally, he was on another planet. Prodigal son that I was, I went for the jugular. Hey, Pop.
Huh?
You know, now that you and Mom are, well, do you have any plans for that property up north?
Not really. Why?
Well, I figured out since you might not be going up there as much, me and the boys could get some use out of it.
Go up whenever you want, Charlie said. Oh, thanks, Dad, but what I meant was, Wince, if you'd be willing to let me put the property up as collateral, we could get a loan to finish the flick. As the words came out, I astonished even myself. I was sure the answer would be returned to me in the form of loud invectives, but Charlie, God bless him, without so much as a glance, tossed a hand in the air. Whatever. Conning Dad was the easy part. The real trick was getting the loan officer of the Mid-Michigan Bank in Gladwin, Michigan, to understand the concept of a blow-up. The officer, tired of our confusing technical explanation, finally stopped us with, "Hey, look, fellas, I don't really give a rat's ass what a blow-up is. It's pretty simple. You return the money when the loan is due, or you risk losing the property. In the meantime, blow up whatever you like." Chapter 21, The First Picture Show. Because of the time and effort it took to get our first film finished, we decided to throw a big premiere and pull out all the stops. This turned out to be a mini-production of its own. Most importantly, we needed the proper venue. The Redford Theater, a grand old revival house circa 1929, was ideal. It could seat over 1,000 patrons easily, had a gigantic screen, and boasted a fully restored pipe organ that rose from the orchestra pit. As the lights of the theater dimmed, stars twinkled subtly in the painted sky. Many of my Saturday evenings had been spent there watching newly minted prints of Ben-Hur, Sound of Music, and Bridge on the River Kwai. It was a splendid place to launch our film. We began to put together a show within a show, custom tickets, programs, and a creepy wind track to create the right tone in the auditorium. For giggles, we posted an ambulance and a security guard in front of the theater, you know, in case any patron found the film too horrific to handle. Many thanks to pioneer Schlockmeister William Castle for that idea. On top of that, you couldn't have a premiere without spotlights, limousines, and tuxedos. Just 2 weeks before the premiere, we finally saw what was then still called Book of the Dead in a local theater late at night on the big screen. The blow-up looked good, really good. As I watched the 35mm images flicker in front of me, the thought rolling around in my head was, crazy, man, crazy. We had laughed in the face of disaster and pulled it off. It was one of the few times in this odyssey when we had a real feeling of accomplishment. Sure, it wasn't sold yet, but at least the current crisis was over. Turnout for the premiere exceeded our expectations. About 1,000 curious relatives, investors, and ex-high school pals seemed to enjoy themselves immensely and whooped it up in almost all the right places. Essentially a melodrama, Evil Dead walked a very fine line. You combine inexperienced actors with a primitive script, and you're bound to get some unexpected laughs. We were happy to have any reaction at all. Shortly after the show, we were told that an elderly woman wanted to see the filmmakers in the lobby right away. The screening was open to the public, so we figured we were going to get an earful.
"Did you fellows make this picture?"
the octogenarian asked in a tone that was hard to read.
Yes, ma'am," Sam replied.
"I just want to tell you boys that I was having such a bad day. I saw the ad for your film and I thought I should get out and see what it was. Well, I'm glad I did because now I feel great and I just wanted to thank you for it."
Thus began our own test screening process. We knew that the audience at the premiere was a deck stacked in our favor. We had to try Evil Dead in front of a pure audience and see if it still played. The decision was an immediate one. Take it back to Michigan State University. Screenings at the State Theater at MSU proved that the film did play. The rowdier the audience, the better. The one thing Evil Dead did was dish out the gore by the shovelful. Chapter 22, Birth of a Salesman. In a rudderless search for a distribution deal, we showed our film to any man, woman, or child for advice. The first targets were filmmakers, just to get sage advice about the do's and don'ts of the Big D.
"Well, you didn't fuck up, but you didn't do great either,"
came the assessment of an exploitation filmmaker.
"It's really crude."
From there, we progressed to booking agents, exhibitors, sub-distributors, packing agents, and lawyers. As helpful as they were, we began to get the impression that we'd be lucky to get any deal at all and that we should take what we could get. We dragged a print to larger distributors on both coasts and in Canada, but the reaction was the same, unanimous disinterest.
"Your picture's pretty bloody," said a distributor. "Have you submitted it for a rating?"
"Well,
No, not exactly. Because if it ain't rated, you're shit out of luck. We needed help. Eventually, the name of a sales agent surfaced, Irvin Shapiro. After doing some research, we saw that his company, Films Around the World, was connected to George Romero's early films. If this man was representing the filmmaker who brought the world Night of the Living Dead, he might just be the right guy for us. Irvin Shapiro had lived a full life before we ever met him. As a young man in his 20s, he had handled the publicity for Battleship Potemkin by filmmaker Sergei Eisenstein. That's a long time ago. Seeing an opportunity to sell foreign films to the U.S., Irvin became one of the founders of the Cannes film market. He was also one of the first entrepreneurs to buy television rights to films and was involved with the company Screen Gems. Irvin often enjoyed pointing out a painting by Picasso hanging on his apartment wall that he had traded the young painter for a bottle of wine. Irvin had been around. On December 10, 1981, we screened our film for this living legend. As the lights came up in the screening room, Irvin cracked a smile.
Well, it ain't gone with the wind, but I think we can make some money with it. Of course, we're going to have to change the title. If you call it Book of the Dead, people are going to think they have to read for 90 minutes. I think we can do better.
Revelation 28c. Making a film and selling it are completely different birds. Back in Ferndale, we kicked some new names around. Irvin sent some ideas to us, and we sent some back to him. Among the classics on the list were Book of the Dead, the original title, Blood Flood, Fee Monsters. I think the tagline was something like, "These bitches are witches." It was ridiculous. Next one, 101% Dead, Death of the Dead, The Evil Dead Men and the Evil Dead Women, and Evil Dead. Evil Dead emerged as the least worst of the bunch. I recall thinking at the time that it was a piss-poor title, but changing it turned out to be the easy part.
"Where are your delivery elements?"
Irvin asked. Rob, Sam, and I exchanged dumb looks. "What's a delivery element?"
"The lab elements you need to sell your picture around the world."
Like?
"Like stills, a foreign textless, an M&E, a dialogue continuity, an interpositive."
This was a depressing prospect because it led to the possibility that we'd have to scrape together even more money, a feat I didn't think we could do. Fortunately for us, Irvin Shapiro was one of the few honorable men in the film business. His company fronted the necessary funds to create these delivery elements. What followed was a lesson in sales from the Grand Master. Madison Avenue in Detroit. In order to sell our film around the world, we had to provide not only the film, but the technical tools necessary for foreign distributors to re-record dialogue in a different language, change the title on the print, and make a new poster. Even if your film was marketable, you couldn't close a deal without these items, and if you couldn't close, you couldn't collect money to pay back the investors. During production, we had taken some pictures, but they were mostly behind-the-scenes stuff or, "Hey, Sam, make a funny face." Nothing useful for promotion. Irvin suggested that we simply fake it. So early in 1982, we got back in action. Our photographer buddy, Mike Ditz, had his own studio just down the street from our offices, and we concocted a number of poses. Armed with a shotgun, shovel, and monster arms, we worked all night creating our first marketing concepts. It was the first time we had to think about how an audience should view this film. Should we be explicit? Should we imply the evil? Because we had no idea what would sell, our photographs represented numerous themes: man versus demon, man and woman versus demons, and even woman overcome by demons. Next on Irvin's list was a trailer or coming attraction, those slick highlights you see in a theater before the main feature. Sam pieced our trailer together in one of the cramped dentist cubicles with a Moviola editing machine that shredded more film than it put together. The process of laying out the first advertisement was more technical than anything. It was all about the dimensions of the paper you were advertising in, and how many screen lines it had, and how to make an original photo into a Velox or a halftone or transparency. It was a bunch of mumbo-jumbo. The idea of photo retouching was a curious peek into the world of advertising. If something in the original picture bothered us, like a visible bolt on the skeleton arm or lack of sheen to the chainsaw blade, we simply changed it. The last items for our promotional shopping cart were easier to come by. I mean, let's face it, every city has a custom t-shirt shop. Our Evil Dead shirts were made at the same place that would have cranked out Biff's Bump Shop or Big Al's Car Stereo Warehouse, so no big challenge there. blank matchbooks we found had to be purchased from a wholesaler before a printing company could adorn their covers, and that buttons could be handmade as long as you bought a few basic tools. This all seemed like a lot of work at the time, but it wasn't until years later that we realized how good we had it. As filmmakers for a studio, you quickly become the fifth wheel once you hand over a completed print. On Evil Dead, however, we had our fingers in every pie and remained connected to the film until the bitter end, for what was to be the first and last time. Armed with 500 matchbooks, 150 t-shirts, 48 hats, 200 buttons, 1,200 brochures, and 500 invitations, Irvin could now do his magic. First stop, the American film market. Just another widget. In case it's all a mystery, buying and selling films isn't all that different from buying and selling clothes hangers. You got a product to sell, and you want to find buyers. Manufactured products are exhibited at trade shows all around the country. You've heard the ads. Don't miss the Home and Garden Expo, this weekend only at the Downtown Convention Center. Films are sold the same way. Three times a year in Los Angeles, Cannes, France, and Milan, Italy, films from around the world are bought and sold like slabs of meat, country by country. In fact, the American meat market would be a more appropriate name. Chronologically, it's the first one of the year, usually in March, and it works like this. The market organizers take over several major hotels, while the sellers, the foreign sales agents, each take a suite in which to hawk their wares. Buyers from around the world wander in and out of the suites, each with a budget and a laundry list of the type of films they're willing to buy. Let's say Joe Germany walks into Acme Foreign Sales Company, and he's looking for a horror picture to round out his purchases. By this point, he may have already seen ads in trade magazines like Variety or Screen International, and knows that Acme represents several horror titles. Acme would show Joe their racks of 8.5 by 11 inch ad slicks, which look like mini movie posters, for the flicks available. And if one interests him, he'll ask for more information. It's an incremental thing. The sellers want to lure the buyer deep into their lair, where the arm twisting can begin. Joe, the buyer, might then wish to see a trailer, like the one Sam edited. If this keeps his interest, he'll arrange to see the entire film at a local cineplex that has been taken over by the film market. If Joe likes what he sees, he'll come back to Acme, and they'll begin negotiations. Having that useless information as a backdrop, enter the three Midwesterners. Chapter 23, La La Land. March 24th, 1982, Rob, Sam, and I arrived in Hollywood. Stepping off the plane, we got the first of many surprises. The weather was lousy. This was supposed to be the land of eternal sunshine, but during the first 2 weeks of our stay, it drizzled almost every day. When the sun did come out, it was a lovely dry heat and the air would be clear, but not for long. Within 24 hours of any rain, an orange-yellow haze would build up until you couldn't see the mountains anymore. Picking up our rent-a-wreck 1965 Cadillac convertible, we took on the L.A. freeways, and they certainly lived up to their reputation. Some sections were 8 lanes in each direction, and made the freeways back in Detroit seem cute in comparison. Still, with no public transportation to speak of, Los Angeles was a car town, and traffic jams occurred at any hour of the night or day. A flat tire or an overheated radiator could start a chain reaction that stretched for miles. Few things were more disturbing than being stuck in a major traffic jam at 1 o'clock in the morning. To my taste buds, cuisine in Southern California was very exotic. In Detroit, Chinese and Italian were about the only ethnic foods available, so it was an eye-opener to sample Japanese, Korean, Thai, or even Mexican food. I wasn't aware how lame the fruits and vegetables were back east until I set foot in a California supermarket. Suddenly, I had 3 choices of lettuce other than iceberg, and I could get strawberries the size of golf balls, but what surprised me most was the orange juice. In Michigan, I never liked the stuff. It was always bitter and awful, but I was led to believe that this was normal. In California, I could get fresh-squeezed orange juice at almost every restaurant, and it was sweet, pulpy, and wonderful. Sociologically speaking, L.A. was a crazy place. The mix of ethnicity was as startling as it was amazing. I had never seen anyone who was Eurasian or a mix of black and Latino. It also puzzled me that attendants at 7-Eleven or even McDonald's, of all places, had trouble with the English language. When we wandered into trendier areas, beautiful people seemed to be everywhere.
A native from L.A. explained that it resulted from generations of pretty people who had come to Hollywood to find fame and fortune mating with other pretty people who had come to Hollywood to find fame and fortune. What really struck me was the amount of attention that people gave to the human body. Working out was the religion of choice in L.A., and if that didn't result in the perfect body, they liposucked, body sculpted, and breast augmented themselves the rest of the way. As twisted as it was, it made sense. I mean, this was Hollywood, the wannabe capital of the world, so why wouldn't every Miss Bootlick Arkansas in the country gravitate there? The thing that saddened me was that the actors I met seemed far more concerned with outward appearance than with training or, dare I say, talent. When we weren't attending screenings of the film or meeting with buyers, we were at the beach, body surfing. I remember the sensation of diving in the Pacific Ocean for the first time. As I surfaced, I spit out a mouthful of water. Yuck, this is salty. As a person accustomed to fresh water, I found this an apt metaphor for Hollywood. It looks inviting on the outside, but if you dive in, you're in for a shock. Can I call you Chuck? The real stunner of that first L.A. experience, though, was the city of Hollywood itself. Nothing like the postcards I'd seen. Hollywood is a seedy place where the rich and famous are scarce, and you're more likely to see hourly motels, hookers, and burned-out rock and rollers. This Hollywood didn't represent the best and the brightest. It was a place where Hugh Grant could get a blowjob. Having said that, I'm happy to say that I met my first movie star there. Rob Sam and I strolled along the Walk of Fame, past the stars of Jack Benny, Dinah Shore, Charlton Heston. Wait, that's no star. That's really him. I ran after him, repeatedly calling out, Mr. Heston! Mr. Heston! Until he had to look back, no doubt trying to gauge my particular level of mania. Yes, he said, not really wanting to stop. Taking advantage of this hesitation, I swung around in front of him and thrust out my hand. He was gracious and patient as I babbled incoherently about this film or that. After sufficient groveling, I let him pass. Charlton Heston would continue to crop up in my life. Irvin's company got us special passes so we could roam the American film market, gawking at the immense amount of independent films for sale. In the evenings, the market organizers lined up a number of splashy showbiz events to wow the prospective buyers. Being an actor in Evil Dead, I was put on the invite list to a swank bash at Universal Studios. After assembling on Soundstage 44, we were herded into an actors-only dining area and seated with other performers. You'll never guess who was at my table. That's right, the Chuckster. I took the opportunity to reintroduce myself. Mr. Heston, Bruce Campbell, how funny that we'd be seated together.
Oh?
Well, we recently met on Hollywood Boulevard. I wasn't really an actor then. I was just a big fan. Thinking I was a gate crasher, Chuck glanced at a nearby security guard before answering.
Did we?
Yep, and now I'm an actor, just like you.
Oh, indeed.
Seeing that my name tag actually matched the place setting at our table, Chuck realized that he had to deal with me.
Have you met my wife, Ben?
That's Bruce.
Yes, of course.
After a rushed piece of chocolate cheesecake, Chuck excused himself from the table, so I hooked up with Rob and Sam again, and we gawked at all the famous actors there, like Martin Landau, David Soul, and Morgan Fairchild. She was there hawking a film, and we huddled up for a picture. As I looked over at Sam, I soon saw why he had such a big smile on his face. He was giving Morgan the rabbit ears behind her head. Recently, I had the opportunity to torment Charlton Heston again at a screening in Hollywood, and I came a stutter away from calling him Chuck. He still didn't recall meeting me, even after my detailed account of the other two times. I have a hunch next time we meet, he'll either recognize me or have me arrested. Chapter 24. Beware the Spores. Spore. Definition. Noun. A primitive, environmentally resistant virus produced by prolonged exposure to bullshit, and capable of robbing the human brain of its abilities to think individually or creatively. Just after a week in Hollywood, Rob Sam and I began to show symptoms of a bizarre disease, including wild mood swings that took us from lethargy to euphoria and back. We found ourselves less concerned with screenings or schedules, and all we really wanted to do was go to the beach. Something had gone terribly wrong, and we didn't know what it was or how to stop it. After doing some independent research with experts in the field, we learned that the spores we had been affected with are a motivation-sapping virus that alters your perceptions of reality. If left untreated for 5 years or more, chronic spore syndrome is likely to develop, CSS. Here's an example of this tragic condition. Since we were in L.A., I decided to look up my old boss, Vern, who had an office on the lot of 20th Century Fox. My tour of the back lot and subsequent meeting with him was exciting, but it wasn't nearly as educational as a conversation with a man on the bus bench outside the studio. As I sat, waiting for Sam and Rob to pick me up in the caddy, a well-tanned man turned his attention to me. "Excuse me, do you have a few dollars for the bus?" he asked, unashamed. As I fished through my pockets for loose change, he went on, jerking a thumb at the Fox lot behind us. "That damn studio had me signed to a 3-picture deal." "Really?" I said, believing him. "Yeah, they insisted that I do my own stunts, and I got hurt on my first picture with them." I looked at my tan friend a little closer. He never made eye contact. A low spore count caused my Michigan suspicions to rise. "Really?" I said again, this time a little less enthusiastic. "Yeah, now they won't pay up, and I'm out of work." "Oh, that's tough," I said, letting the coins drop back into my pocket. But he wasn't done explaining. "See, I was a famous child actor. I was one of the kids in Lassie." "Oh," I said, looking for Rob and Sam in the caddy. "Good for you." The odd thing about this last reference was that it was so specific. For all I knew, the poor sap was a child actor who was driven insane by a strange profession. I didn't really want to get into it, and luckily the convertible arrived to save me from further discussion. In my own efforts to rid the world of spores, I have tabulated a few early warning signs. You know the spores have gotten you when your day-to-day decision-making process is ruled by fear instead of reason. You wear black to every Hollywood function. You deny the fact that you're from Gary, Indiana. You begin to despise your body. You attend parties hosted by losers hoping to meet a winner. You entertain the notion of having a cell phone surgically implanted in your ear. Here's a few examples of spore speak. "Look, I can't tie up the line. I'm waiting for Paramount, Universal, and Columbia to call me back. Once I get my teeth fixed, I'm going to be a star. Titanic was the best film I've ever seen." All spore speak. Chapter 25, Playing Kick the Can. The feeding frenzy of sales continued in May 1982 at the Cannes Film Market in France. Since the event was an ocean away, Irvin Shapiro's budget could scarcely afford to send all of us, so Sam, as auteur, was chosen to go. Having learned a lesson or two from the American film market, we tweaked a few of our sales items, notably a brochure which we translated into French. To do this, Sam and I enlisted our high school French teacher, the venerable Madame Tessum. In addition to a fine translation, she also coached Sam on local customs, maps, etc. Here on the French Riviera, we got our next break. At one of many screenings, Stephen King happened to see our film. He liked Evil Dead so much, he wrote a hearty endorsement in the magazine Twilight Zone. In the article, he stated that Evil Dead was the, quote, most ferociously original horror film of the year. You can't buy that type of promotion, so we begged him to let us use that phrase on all of our advertisements. He agreed, and it made a huge difference. A plug from one of horror's legends sent up a protective force field around our little film. Suddenly, critics took a second or even first look at it, and several good reviews rolled in. Among them was the LA Times, pronouncing Evil Dead an instant classic. Eventually, with the invaluable assistance of Mr. King, our film began to sell, territory by territory around the globe. England promoted Evil Dead like it was an A picture. I'm not sure how Prince Charles felt about the theater, named after him, displaying giant photos of possessed monsters, but it happened nonetheless. Eventually, Evil Dead became the number one video seller in England for 1983. It was a treat to look further down the list and see Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. Sorry, Stan. Chapter 26, The Downside of the Upside. Eventually, with money coming in from overseas, New Line Cinema took renewed interest. I'd be a liar if I said the negotiation process was a love fest, but eventually we signed a distribution deal with them. January 6, 1983, we got our first domestic check. That same day, we spent 8 hours at the accountant's, sorting through 4 years of our shadowy past, trying to determine exactly who got what amount and when. We paid back 33% of our loans with that first New Line check. We were also able to keep that small-town bank in the middle of Michigan from seizing my family's property, and all three of us were able to pay off 2 months' worth of bills. It was a start. February 4, 1983, Evil Dead had a sneak preview in New York. This was pre-Disney New York, and the crowd on 42nd Street ate it up. Detroit was the same. May 6th, I snuck into the Showcase theaters and enjoyed a rowdy audience reaction. It was a thrill to see our film playing in the same theater I had patronized for years, but it was something of an anticlimax. Evil Dead had taken 4 years to make, but its theatrical run was only a couple of months, too short to get any sense of success. Then there were the other reviews, the ones that made you want to crawl into a hole and die. I joined Evil Dead in Los Angeles for the Filmex Festival. Fielding questions after the screening, the first inquiry put it all in perspective. So, Bruce, are you going to use real actors next time? More pot shots came from various reviews around the country. Sickest of the Sick was Atlanta's description of the film. Films That Stoop headlined another entertainment review. After getting almost universal praise for Evil Dead, I suppose it was the balance we needed. Evil Dead footnote. All in all, our investors got their money back after 6 years. 19 years later, due to a built-up demand, we were back on the video charts at number 3, right behind Titanic and Lady and the Tramp. I fear for that buried time capsule. Its days are numbered. I recently attended a film festival in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. At a meet-and-greet session, a rock was plunked down in front of me, a craggy, tooth-like rock similar to that used in the construction of the fireplace of our cabin? Bruce, where the flying hell did you get this? Fan.
Your cabin was in Morristown, Tennessee, right?
Yeah.
Well, we went there and found it. The fireplace was the only thing that was standing.
He was right. The place burned down in late 1980. Over the years, this obscure cabin in the hills has become a mecca of sorts for the truly devoted. I did my best to dodge various emails and letters from deadites, an affectionate term, asking where they might find this mythical cabin. But my efforts have come to naught. The word is out. Chapter 27. Working in the Industry. BC becomes an actor. Email. Well, Bruce, you've done it this time. You've joined the ranks of such hard heads as Sharon Stone, Barbara Streisand, Whoopi Goldberg, and Alec Baldwin. And I hate it. I thought you were different. Thought you had it all together. But you had to go and throw in your 2 cents in defense of King Clinton. Every time I turn on the TV, some two-bit actor is giving their opinion on this whole matter, while Billy Bob Buttscratch, who has more brains than all of SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, has to listen to this tripe. Just act, will ya? Go, Bruce, go sing We Are the World with your activist friends. Marty M. I'm a little fuzzy on when I officially declared myself an actor. I'd been exposed on film for 10 years with varying success, but I never made a living at it. And by Detroit standards, I couldn't say I was an actor until I could. While Evil Dead was in post-production, there was a rush trip to New York to audition for a romantic comedy. The project was hardly worth the plane fare, but try and tell that to a young actor with no perspective. I co-hosted a pilot for an automotive talk show. The Motor City seemed like a logical place to film such a thing, but nothing ever came of it. During a sales trip to Los Angeles, I met with a manager for the first time and showed him some clips from the film. I think you could be a star, but you need to lose some weight, was the only assessment. The fact that I still lived in Detroit didn't help either. What came of that meeting was the need for a headshot, an 8x10 black and white photograph that best represented what I was all about. This was an alien concept for me, since I had never marketed myself before. What kind of an actor was I? A funny actor? A serious actor? A character actor? In Detroit, talent agencies solved that problem by insisting that clients create a composite photo that showcased your versatility. To prepare for this, I looked at other, quote, comps. If you're ever in need of great entertainment, go to a talent agency and thumb through their stack of construction workers, on-the-go executives, and happy homemakers. A trip to Mike Ditz's photo studio put the pictures in motion. There, I'm embarrassed to admit, I allowed myself to be photographed as the unshaven, shirtless stud, the slick James Bond dude, and the bespectacled potato chip-eating geek. I'm not sure if these photos helped or hindered me, but at least I was ready to be submitted. One of my first bites from the outside world was a role in a promotional commercial for a Detroit TV station. Okay, it wasn't a role. I was hired to be an extra. Mind you, an extra in a 90-minute feature film has a chance of being seen. An extra in a 60-second commercial might as well do cartwheels naked for all the screen time they'll get. Still, I was happy for the 1.5 seconds of exposure. After several auditions, I managed to land the role of teacher Alan Stewart in a homegrown soap opera called Generations. The basic scenario was no different than the average soap, a bunch of upscale people enduring never-ending personal problems. It wasn't exactly Harold Pinter, but they were paying $35 a scene, 35 more than I had ever made before. The only lasting benefit of doing this soap, other than paying off my Sunoco credit card, was learning to memorize lines of dialogue quickly and meeting an actress named Christine DeVoe. She played my love interest on the show, and to perpetuate an old cliché, we became involved off-screen as well. I must admit, what attracted me most to Chris was her attraction to me. Simplistic, yes, but this was the first time a woman had openly expressed an interest, and I responded in kind. Having been married before, Chris had first-hand knowledge of things like long-term commitment and cohabitation, but it was all Greek to me. Until Chris appeared on the scene, the film business was my only mistress demanding full attention. Now I had to divide my time more equally. Waking up next to the same person each morning and coming home to them every night was an exciting dynamic, and it felt very comfortable. Within 6 months, talk of the Big M peppered our conversations. Because marriage is such a personal affair, Chris and I felt that we alone should determine every aspect of the process, including when, where, and how it should take place. As a result, we shocked the daylights out of Reverend Cowick at our first meeting at the Franklin Community Church. Rev, it's so nice to have you two here. I'm really looking forward to... Bruce, yeah. Rev, could you marry us right now? I beg your pardon? Chris, we have everything with us. Well, I... Bruce, could you? Right here? But I don't even know you. Bruce, well, with all due respect, Reverend, you never will. This is between the two of us and the big guy upstairs. Reverend Cowick remained unconvinced, however, and encouraged